Hello and welcome again to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. Of course, you know me. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. And with me, as always, are my two gregarious, wonderful co-hosts, Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Give me a second to look up the word gregarious.
All right. While you're doing that, I can introduce Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hi. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Oh. Hey, it's not bad.
Gregarious is not bad, no.
It sounds, phonetically, it just sounds bad.
It sounds like it might be a backhanded compliment.
Or just a very negative adjective.
All right. Well, now that we've gotten through that and we all know that we're still on good terms because
set the tone for the episode.
I haven't privately insulted anyone yet. Yes, so anyone just joining us, first of all, welcome. Second of all, we're going to be talking today about the new release for this weekend, Paranorman, which is directed by Chris Butler and Sam Fell, and starring the voice talents of Cody Smit-McPhee and Anna Kendrick, amongst many others. First, however, we're going to talk about a brief discussion topic, which this week will be public reactions and re-reactions and just the interplay between different artists in the film sphere giving their opinions about other people's work. Before we get into that, though, I'd like to remind everyone at home, as always, subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, comment on iTunes. If you can do it to us on iTunes, I encourage you to do it. Take that however you want. I did not mean it to sound as dirty as it did. And also, if you have anything you'd like to say to us, you know, you can always get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So, into our discussion topic, everyone, well, maybe not everyone, but many people may have already heard, David Cronenberg this week made a statement about Christopher Nolan's Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises. It's been called a slam. I hate using that word because that's just journalist speak for this is a negative thing and I don't know what to say about it. He said, "I don't think they are making them an elevated art form regarding the movies. I think it's still Batman running around in a stupid cape. I just don't think it's elevated. Christopher Nolan's best movie is Memento, and that's an interesting movie." He then goes on to say, "It's adolescent in its core. That has always been its appeal, and I think people who are saying, you know, Dark Knight Rises is cinema, supreme cinema art, I don't think they know what the fuck they are talking about." So we wanted to get into this, because obviously this is a lot different than a critic, per se, chastising a movie. Nick, I know you have an opinion on this kind of ecosystem of critique and remark, so why don't you kick us off here?
To kick off, I would say that David Cronenberg's comments are brash and uncalled for, but I don't think it's a big deal, personally. I personally feel that when it comes to something like this, you have to think about the people who are directly involved with this. That's David Cronenberg and that's Christopher Nolan. Cronenberg doesn't really need to worry about himself. I read a few comments where they were saying, well, David Cronenberg's just jealous because Christopher Nolan's more successful. He's more successful, but does Cronenberg have something to be jealous of? He's revered. He's does well for himself and he wins awards and he's got my back, or I've got his back.
I
wish David would have my back, but he probably doesn't. So you have to think about that and then look at the perspective from Christopher Nolan. Do you think he really cares? I'm sure he respects Cronenberg as a filmmaker, and personally, if I was him, I'd be a little upset when I read it, but then I'd move on because my films make $1 billion and I can do whatever I want and Michael Caine likes me. You see? So I do think that in that sense, I think the two guys are just fine. I think they're going to be just fine. But it is fascinating for people like us, the three of us, to look at it because we're doing film criticism, quote unquote, and we're saying things that are not that far out of line with what Cronenberg is spouting publicly. But when we do it, it's just it's who cares, you know? Obviously, the people listening to this want to hear us speak, but when it's not going to – what we say is not going to reach past a certain audience. But you Google David Cronenberg's name lately, and there's stories appearing in Entertainment Weekly, and I think I saw the New York Times cover it a bit. So essentially what I'm trying to say, and what I've taken too long to say, is that it's fascinating for film critics to look at, and I think film fans too, but ultimately this is a passing, I don't even want to say storm, it's a passing occurrence, but it's a lot of fun.
I agree that it's passing. I think one of the reasons that it made such ripples is just that it is kind of really rare for one director to call out another director in kind of this way. And it really, if you read the comment, which I already have out loud for everyone listening, it's not even about Christopher Nolan. It's about the audience who is trying to elevate The Dark Knight Rises to a level of Citizen Kane, I guess would be the go-to. Though I guess now we're on Vertigo. This was the same thing. I mean, there were people asking after The Dark Knight came out whether or not it was the best movie ever made. And it's a difference between, I think Christopher Nolan is a pop artist. I think he knows what he's making when he's making something like The Dark Knight. Like, he knows the field he's playing in. And I think David Cronenberg plays in a completely different field.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly a different sport. I mean, these are not men who are making movies that are hoping to achieve the same end game. Christopher Nolan is definitely a great cinematic artist, but I don't think that he's applied himself to the types of movies that really should be called supreme cinema art. So on some level, I think Dave Cronenberg has a point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just weird. Like I said, I mean, it's the contrast between The Dark Knight Rises and The Zeitgeist. David Cronenberg obviously has got a new movie coming out, so you got two people who are suddenly at the forefront of public eye, and one of them says something and suddenly everyone thinks that there needs to be a problem. I don't think that this will ever be elevated to like a real rivalry or spitting match, nor should it be. And I think that,
although if you think about it, Cronenberg isn't really in the public eye right now because Cosmopolis is coming out in such a limited capacity, you know?
Okay. So maybe the critical eye.
Well, but I think that is part of it though. And what makes it interesting is that one has a movie coming out in, I think like 6 theaters this past weekend, and right, The Dark Knight Rises is still playing across the country and still will be for like at least a month or so. So I find that contrast particularly interesting too, how you have this sort of seasoned veteran who's releasing a movie in a much tinier capacity and someone who only really became, I don't want to say noteworthy because following is pretty good, but only became well-known about 10 years ago. Not even well-known, but just anybody knew his name 10 years ago. The fact that anybody knew it then
was kind of a big deal for him.
But do you see what I mean by that? How it is an interesting contrast. There's sort of these four levels. You have big movie, small movie, and then you have a veteran who's kind of doing something small and a newer guy who's doing something big. I like those layers to it. Yeah, that makes it a particularly interesting story for me.
Going off that, one of the things I find interesting about comparing Cronenberg to Nolan here is that Cronenberg admits that Nolan kind of achieved something special cinematically with Memento, and after that is when he made the jump into Batman. But it's not like Christopher Nolan is necessarily saying Batman was like the best material he could have done after his early career. Mm-hmm. But he was, you know, he must have been 30, early 30s at the time. And if Warner Brothers wants to give you $100 million to make Batman Begins and you think you have a good story, like, would David Cronenberg have said no to that offer if he got it in his mid-30s? So David Cronenberg is at a place in his career where he knows exactly what he's done and he knows exactly where he's going, and there's not a lot of changes. But with Chris Nolan, he's still so young, you know, who's to say he won't come out in a couple of years and make a $10 million psychological thriller.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he'll do that next. For all
Hopefully. I mean, it would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like that kind of goes back to what I said. I mean, Christopher Nolan is a good cinematic artist, and I don't think that Dave Cronenberg's out of line to say that people who are saying that The Dark Knight Rises supreme cinema art might be a little crazy. Like, I don't think, would any of us say that The Dark Knight Rises achieves a level of cinematic nirvana that really deserves to be called, you know, cinema art of the supreme kind?
I mean, I think all films are art, but I don't think it's cinematic art of the supreme sort, no.
I'm very careful to continue saying exactly what he said, because I don't want to be, I don't want it to appear that I'm trying to put words in his mouth. Like, I'm not, yeah. I'm specifically not saying a good film, because he doesn't make any kind of qualification on whether or not it's an enjoyable, entertaining film.
He said it's boring.
No, did he?
He didn't directly say that, but he...
Well, he said that superhero movies are boring.
Well, he said on a technical level, films of that sort are impressive, but it's boring, which is basically, you know...
But then again, I mean, I don't know. It's Cronenberg. I mean, this is the man who made Naked Lunch. I think a lot of things are boring to him that the rest of us might not agree with.
Are you insulting Naked Lunch?
No, I love Naked Lunch. I'm just saying that's a movie that goes places. Oh, and once you've been there, I believe that Batman would be boring to you. Once you've had to create living insectoid typewriters and aliens that excrete drugs. If you haven't seen Naked Lunch, ladies and gentlemen at home, you should go check it out, because I'm not doing it enough justice. It's
pretty Don't eat lunch while you're doing it.
Especially no, not naked.
I was not hungry after I watched that film.
Wait, what?
I watched that movie at like 9 in the morning, and I had to pause it for a bit, so by the time I finished it, it was like around noon or lunchtime, and I was just like, I'm going to sit this one out. It's a true story, really.
I watched it around midnight one day, and that was an even worse decision, I think.
Yeah.
That movie gets in your brain. This is becoming an ad hoc review of David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch. Does anyone have any final thoughts on this? I mean, I've tried to kind of downplay the level of possible controversy that it could be. I think David Cronenberg, like I just said, he's the type of person who would find things like that boring. The big blockbusters that get put out in, 300,000 theaters. That's not even possible. 3,000 theaters. I mean,
yeah.
The man who's not making those films, he's going to find them boring, because there is a formula and there is kind of a marketability to it. There's not a lot that's challenging about it.
A lot of people would find Cosmopolis boring too, which I think is kind of interesting to think about. You know what the thing is, though, is that I can't, if I didn't like Cosmopolis, I would probably have a stronger opinion. I don't want to say overall, but I would definitely have a problem with Cronenberg's comments, but Cosmopolis is better than The Dark Knight Rises, so
I haven't seen it yet, so I can't defend or agree with you in either way.
Right. No, I'm just saying, like, in my opinion, it's a better film, so I love Christopher Nolan, don't get me wrong, but I kind of have to sit this one out in a certain sense.
It's never a bad thing to say that something is a better film. This is another thing. I guess we could get into this, because, like I said, Cronenberg was kind of calling out fans and audience. Everyone seems to think that there has to be some kind of win scenario. I've gotten into this conversation a lot with people between The Dark Knight Rises and The Avengers. There's just this feeling like, if you're not saying that my movie is the best, then you're saying that it's awful. And this is something we've actually brought up, I believe, before when we were talking about, people attacking reviewers and just all this other stuff, like geek backlash against properties. I mean, what is that? Like, instead of allowing this statement by Cronenberg to lead us to an examination of the differences between, like, pop art and perhaps more serious-minded stuff, everyone's kind of, like, spoiling for some kind of catfight. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. I don't understand. And maybe that's just me. I'm a man who likes discussion. I personally find it boring to be surrounded by people who agree with me.
I think it's fun. I think this is fun. Generally, I find that geek backlash is just kind of tiring. But this isn't that. This is just... you know, the thing is, it's because it's like what I said before. David Cronenberg knows what he's talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So when someone on a message board is like, well, maybe the movie's not very good, I'm just kind of like, okay. Cool. But when Cronenberg says it, you listen,
Yeah.
I think that kind of goes without saying.
Especially, I mean, if you just want to look at... I'll close out by saying this, because I can get behind what Cronenberg's saying, because Batman in and of himself is a cinematic emblem. It's a cinematic creation. Like, you have a comic book, graphic novel, whatever you'd like to call it. It's basically a storyboard for a movie. It's very easy to take that and adapt it to film, because those two mediums... truck in very much the same language. I have read Cosmopolis. I cannot begin to imagine how David Cronenberg was able to fashion an interesting, engaging film out of that novel. Because at times it does play like a series of debates between straw men for different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited for it, because that is the less boring, more interesting thing to make. And I would like to see how he does it, because I think that he's very good at what he does.
Did you, so you enjoyed the book?
I did. You know, the dialogue is great. The ideas in it are interesting. As a story, I don't know, because the plot slash narrative of it is pretty basic.
Yeah.
But as a series of ideas espoused intelligently by interesting people, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. So I'm looking forward to the movie to see if it is able to maybe cobble together something more than that. I've been religiously avoiding any and all reviews to the best of my ability. So, but yeah, does anyone else have any final thoughts on this before we move on?
I just have one quick thing briefly, is just that I really like the timing of Cronenberg saying something like this, because with the Sight and Sound director's poll coming out online, like, it's just put me into this mindset of being more interested than normal of like what directors think about other movies. And even though he's obviously panning this and not calling it one of his 10 favorites, it's still kind of in that same ballpark where it's just inherently interesting to someone like me and probably you too.
Yeah, that's something that always interests me. I'm always on the lookout to see what directors are, what they're praising. Which is, it's funny because, you know, I love Quentin Tarantino to death, but his top 10 lists every year are the most baffling things.
Was there anything particularly baffling on this year's list?
He had the Three Musketeers. That was one.
Yeah, it's like his top 10 of the year, not his Sight and Sound.
His Sight and Sound one wasn't that surprising. I mean, he had the Bad News Bears, but otherwise it was...
I think he also had Rise of the Planet of the Apes on his 2011 one.
God damn it. Like, really high.
Yeah.
X-Men First Class as well.
X-Men First Class I could kind of get behind, but Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I will hate that movie.
What?
It's a terrible film.
Movie's so much fun.
That movie is an infuriating, frustrating mess.
Ugh.
I'm in the middle. I think it's half good. So that's a... Going off of Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, coming off of our hatred from Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I think talking about that piece of shit movie, we should move on into a much better film, in my opinion. We're going to now give you our review of Paranorman, which, as I said before, is directed by Chris Butler and Sam Fell, with the voice talents of Cody Smith McPhee, Casey Affleck, Anna Kendrick, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Leslie Mann, Jeff Garlin, and I'd say those are the biggest names. Oh, John Goodman. Completely forgot about that.
Meet Norman.
Can't you be like other kids your age?
His parents don't get him.
He's probably up there fiddling with his Ouija or his orb.
Harry.
His sister doesn't like him.
You are such a loser.
And the kids at school.
Look, it's abnormal.
Always pick on him. But he does have some friends.
Norman, wait up.
I like to be alone.
So do I. Let's do it together.
It's just that most of them.
Good morning.
Aren't exactly alive.
How's it hanging?
Haven't heard that one before.
Do you see ghosts like all the time?
So Paranorman is the new stop action animated film from Laika. I'm pronouncing that correctly, right?
You are, yes.
Okay,
excellent. It's the name of the dog that was sent into space.
Is it?
By the Russians, yeah. And then it was made into that great Arcade Fire song.
I thought that was Laska or something.
No, Laika.
Oh, crazy. So the animated... That actually makes a lot of sense, given the tone of this film. The animated film company named after the dog that the Russians shot into space with no intention of ever bringing back. Bleak story. Kind of a bleak movie.
This is the first animal to die in orbit, as well.
That's an ignominious honor. This is a movie about Norman, who is a regular, you know, 12, 11-year-old boy, except for the fact that he can see and speak to the dead. That's your basic plot. There's a witch's curse. There's a lot of stuff happening in this film. Yeah, well, we should just jump into our feelings about this. Danny, why don't you start us off? Tell us what you thought of Paranorman.
I liked Paranorman. It was kind of a twofold experience to me because I loved the character and I love kind of like the day in the life stuff that it starts off with, where he's walking to school and you see him say hi to everyone, and of course you can't see them at first because they're all ghosts or spirits. And then he gets bullied at school, and he watches horror movies at home and talks to his dead grandma, and that stuff's really cool. And the movie looks great. When you start concerning yourself with the narrative specifics and kind of how they try to force conflict into the movie, I think it gets really annoying and almost second rate in a lot of the second half. At the same time, I know that if I rewatch it in the future, I'll be able to just not even care about the story and just focus on how good it looks. I'm sure it'll just continue to be really enjoyable. But I do think the story is kind of pretty weak.
And Nick, what about yourself?
It almost feels like a disservice to discuss this film in words, because this movie is all about the visuals from top to bottom. And Danny is right. The story is, or I shouldn't say right, it's his opinion. We're on the same page. The story is pretty thin and almost feels like something they had to do when they were making this film and not something they wanted to do. I think that's very much reflected when you look at the animation, which is so beautiful and so meticulous and so enveloping. I mean, this movie is never boring to look at. It's always... It's everything from the specificity, can't pronounce that word, but you know what I mean, of the animation to the color palette, which has a very kind of like autumn Halloween tone to it. And not only that, but there's also the music. All of that's great. And it's also a really funny movie, too. But the story itself is, you know, witch's curse. They got to get a book. They're teaming up to get the book. Whatever. And obviously that's a problem, but I can sort of let that go when the rest of the film is... I mean, I'll hold it against the movie, of course, because I'm responsible, but the rest of the film is so impressive that it's holding up remarkably well in my memory. And, you know, I would not object to seeing this one again.
I might have to come to the defense of this movie on a story level.
All right.
Let's hear it.
The thing is, it's true. I mean, you're saying the story is thin and it feels maybe a little bit perfunctory, or it's something they had to do. And that's possible. I mean, I can't say enough good things about the just sheer craft of this film. That scene that opens it when he's speaking with his grandmother, and then they reveal that she's dead and that he's actually been talking to a ghost. And then he's walking down the street and he's waving to no one, and then suddenly you can see everyone that he's talking to. Like, that's just some really good filmmaking. Like,
yeah.
That's going to probably stand out in my mind as one of the best scenes that I've seen this year. There's something about it, between the music and the voice acting and the simple animation and design of the character. And the design of all the characters in this is really good, but Norman especially, you do just get a sense from looking at him straight away before he's even put into motion of just the alienation that this kid feels and the unhappiness in him, but still the kind of slightly buoyant undertone of it. Like, he's still holding on, he's still okay. And so that scene just kind of blew me away. And I think that it would have been really hard for the movie to get me off of its side after having seen that. The story is very, very simple. Like, there's no side tracks, there's no subplots, really. It's just this one story. And that's, I think, something that some people would have problems with, because it does seem like it's not a fully fleshed out narrative. But I appreciated that in some way. I mean, I like the fact that they didn't give him the random romantic person that he has to, like, get the girl to love him before something happens, or, you know, things like that. There's this, he has one objective, and when he completes it, you know, things have kind of fallen into place. So I think I appreciate it on that level. I liked the fact that it trusted its single story and its craft enough to let that support the film, rather than trying to shoehorn in a lot of other elements that another lesser film might have tried. Does that make sense?
Yeah, just going off that, you're basically talking about how simple the narrative was, and I almost wish that it would have embraced that simplicity almost even more, because where it really started to bug me was not when the movie was just kind of a substanceless zombie chase, because as a monster movie, it's really fun and great to look at. It just kind of bugged me when they bring in these flashbacks and try to, like, throw in the substance really quick, and there's a lot of speeches And that's kind of where it loses me.
Yeah.
Really? I love that.
So, yeah, that would be my response.
Yeah, the stuff where they're... oh, God, the scene where they're in the van is so good. It's
that's
beautifully composed,
scene.
And it's actually kind of thrilling. And it's also very funny. We should mention, give a shout-out to Casey Affleck, voicing the main character, his friend, the friend's brother. He's supposed to be kind of like this jockey sort. And you would not think to put Casey Affleck in that role, but, man, he nails it.
Yeah,
he's really perfect.
He is perfect.
And yeah, like this, just the quips that they all make and all that, that's great fun. But it is then when you get to the scene where they get to the public libraries when it kind of starts to falter, unfortunately. Thankfully, the movie's kind of mostly over by that point.
I'm actually legitimately surprised that words like faltered and, you know, falls apart are getting thrown around here. Like, I loved that. I don't. This idea that there's a problem there is shocking to me. Like, when we can get into it in spoilers more, I think it's really hard to talk about it without getting into spoilers. I think that the turn, if we can just say that much, is really well done and adds a lot of depth to the film. And it's not just, you know, shoehorned in depth. Like, it's meaningful depth that ties into the very character himself. You're saying this and I'm like... completely blown away by it.
How do you think it ties into the character?
We have to get into it in spoilers.
Okay.
I would say that anything that happens after they get into the library almost would have to be saved for spoilers. We'll get into that. I do want to say a special shout out, and whoever was in this film in their production part and decided that Alvin, the school bully, should be doing really crappy breakdancing to Dizzy Rascal's Fix Up Look Sharp. That is just a stroke of genius, and you're my best friend forever. Like, that scene was happening, and I just couldn't stop smiling. And I think people in the theater were, like, frightened by my reaction, because they had no idea why I was so happy about that. But yeah. Does anyone have any non-spoilery things to say?
Well, I just want to... Can we talk about the direction a little bit? Chris Butler and Sam Fell... did a really this movie is so well directed. Like, was anybody else surprised by that? Like the depth of the shots, for example, how much there is going on in the frame at one point. Interesting angles being employed, and
There's a lot of like canted angles.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel egregious because it's sort of intrinsic to this kind of movie, right? Very very wisely employed, I thought. I would say this is probably, in terms of direction, maybe the best directed animated movie since, like, well, Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Another stop-motion film.
Yeah.
Maybe that says something.
I did want to talk about that. Initially, when we were bringing up discussion topics, I wanted to just kind of touch on whether or not the medium of a film, especially an animated film, kind of colors your vision towards it or gives you a greater appreciation for it. The differences between, like, CG and stop motion and hand-drawn. Do you feel like you have an affinity for one over the other? Or that is it just kind of a question of what the story would call for and how well it fits? Because I really, if this wasn't stop motion, I feel like it would have a very different tone and texture to it. Like, I feel like this was the one way that you could shoot this kind of movie. Like, I don't think this would have done as well in CG.
No, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I'm not a fan of the film discussion argument. What if the movie was, or what if the movie wasn't? Because I kind of, I'm not a fan of the rhetorics.
Yeah, I'm just talking about, like, in general, like when
But I do understand what you mean, and yeah. I will admit I am biased towards stop motion because I think it's really cool, and I guess I do give a movie higher marks just for being that, only in the sense that, which am I supposed to admit that? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is I have some idea of how ridiculously complicated this process is. And if you stay after the credits for this movie, there's a quick little fun thing where they show how they made the Paranorman figure. And it's done in like a extremely super – fast motion or whatever, and even then it kind of takes a while to be assembled, and you see it and it's staggering. That's just one character, and they're not doing his animation yet. they haven't, they're not building the sets and everything. That's just one small aspect of the film, you see?
Right.
So when you, I think when you know how hard it is to make this happen, you, it's only right to give it a little nudge.
Yeah, and that's exactly how I feel about it. It's just a question of care and of, you know, the personal touches and just
if the stop motion is bad, then I think I would actually like this movie less, because I'd be a little bothered by that fact. But it's so good.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like the tone, the direction of this film, the voice acting is really, really quite good. I couldn't think of many marks to give it off. I mean, like you said, Casey Affleck is incredible. John Goodman was hilarious as Mr. Pendergast. And Cody Smith McPhee was moving. Is that a good word for it? Would anyone fight me on that? I think he did a really
moving
great job.
Moving than in the road.
Norman. More moving than the road?
Than in the road. He irritated me so much in that movie. Seriously.
I can get behind
about that. A movie from late 2009.
No, I can get behind that. I mean, In the Road, it's
a tough role.
Yeah, no, it's a ridiculously tough role.
And in that sense, maybe he's supposed to be annoying. I don't know.
But part of me thought he was, honestly. Like, but that's The Road. Difficult to really talk about that.
Although, you know what I'm realizing now? He was in Let Me In, and he was good in that movie. He was very good in that movie, actually. So what am I even? I should shut up. He's a good actor.
Yeah, shut up, Nick. Jesus.
I just forgot he was the kid in that movie.
So really the only problems that we had here seem to be the story and where it goes. So I feel like now to dive into that and kind of get to the meat of this movie, we should get into spoilers. So spoilers for Paranorman. I'm going to say go out, see it in theaters, and see it in 3D, because I'm not usually a fan of 3D films. But this movie, I think, is used to great effect.
I saw this in 2D.
You saw it in 2D. Oh, Nick.
Okay.
Nick, you're not even allowed in this discussion. You didn't see this movie the way it was meant to be.
I didn't see it in 48 FPS, but actually it was more a matter of convenient timing, because I would have had to see it today if I was going to see it in 3D. And I was thinking, I got 3 hours to kill. We might as well go now.
Yeah, me seeing in 3D.
I didn't feel like I was missing much by seeing in 2D, but then again, I'll never know. Unless I see it again in 3D.
I was about to say, I would go see it again in 3D.
What about the 3D was particularly noteworthy? Because it more seemed like it was an issue of depth than stuff coming at you.
Yeah, no, it's pretty good with not just doing the stuff coming at you thing. There's like maybe one thing that I can think of right offhand. I would say depth, and as someone who pointed out how much you liked how well this was directed and about the depth and everything going on in the scene, I mean, I feel like you might actually be missing something by not having that in there.
Maybe. I mean, bear in mind, I do like coming at you 3D, though, so I'm not speaking out against that. I just feel like, in this instance, it's more about depth than anything else.
Yeah. Well, like I said, there are a few coming out to get you points, and again, they're done kind of in that style and in that reverence and tone of the old B-movie thrillers, so.
Yeah, I feel like Coraline, which is also from Laika, was maybe the 3D in that was a little more important, because that was about going into a different world, and there's those great shots where it's the elongating tunnel.
Yeah.
And things like that. Paranorman doesn't really seem to have much of that.
So. No, I would say not. And Coraline really was great with that. All right, so everyone agrees, see it in theaters, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Danny, did you think the 3D was worth paying the extra couple bucks for?
It's hard for me to say, just because I don't know how many movies I've seen in both 3D or 2D. So, you know, like when I saw the 3D, one of the things I liked about it was that it wasn't, you know, in your face all the time, and it did have a very good balancing of depth, which is also one of the things that I really liked about the 3D in Pina. Not that they're similar films in any way, but the fact that Nick got like the sense of depth in 2D, you know, I'm almost interested to see it in 2D just to figure out if there is much of a difference. But the 3D glasses were green, and that was pretty cool. I know how much you like green, Nick, so that might be something worth buying.
You know, I was driving the other day, and I was thinking about how I don't like the color green that much in relation to Vertigo. That always kind of bothered me about that movie because I don't particularly care for the color green. So it kind of bothered me when I saw that movie.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Nick Newman, not a fan of the color green.
Yeah.
Shocking.
That's such a weird...
You say that like I there's some sort of precedent for me not liking the color green.
No, shouldn't there be a precedent for you liking the color green?
For me liking it?
Yeah.
Like
being alive as far in as I know. The world. We're getting off topic. Nick Newman doesn't like green. That's odd. But let's get into spoilers for Paranorman. This film, I mean, there's a point. There's a witch's curse. The dead are supposed to rise. Specifically, 7 men who were responsible for hanging a witch. Maybe I didn't do a good enough job of in the non-spoiler section saying how freaking dark this movie gets. Because I went alone, and I can't imagine bringing a child to this movie. You know, maybe like... maybe child's not the right word. You look at an animated film and you think probably like 4 and up is a good age for it. I would say this one you might want to wait a little bit longer for.
Yeah.
You say nah or yeah?
No, I go yeah.
Yeah. Because this movie, like I said, there's about a witch who gets hung. A lot of talk about murder and death in this film, as you'd expect, and that's fine. What happens, though, is you find out that the 7 Walking Dead, who are apparently terrorizing everyone, are not actually terrorizing everyone. They're just trying to get to Norman because they know he can speak to them in order to tell him what's going on and like try to get him on their side. The problem with this is that the reason these men have a curse on them is because they hung the witch, who it turns out was a young girl about Norman's age.
Yeah, I thought the disembowelment scene was really bad, too.
I was about to say, and then she's drawn and quartered. It was awful. You red yarn everywhere. This did not happen.
No.
Yeah, no, I mean, you said anything after the public library when it was putting the story in was a little nuts. I mean, I thought that you have this overarching, vague mythology going on where these 7 guys are going to rise from the dead. And to turn them from enemies into people suffering under a curse because the thought is that people will fear them and harm them was really good. And then the turnaround from having the witch be an old crone to being a poor little 11-year-old girl who just has a power that no one else understands, I mean, that's an obvious tie-in to Norman. The way that people treat him, obviously they're not hanging him from the neck until dead after a witch trial, but they're not making his life any easier. Like, his father says hurtful things about him, people write things on his locker with such stunning frequency that he has Windex and a rag in his locker specifically for that purpose. And I think having him have to go and speak to her during a very harrowing, really messed up scene, I say that in a good way. Like, everything about this movie I really liked. That scene is really intense.
Which scene do you refer to?
When he goes into the woods to her grave and there's trees closing in everywhere.
Oh.
And spikes that sound like jagged razor blades are coming out of the ground, and then she's just zapping him and throwing him against stuff. Like, this is nuts, right? Like,
it's definitely not a pleasant atmosphere for Norman.
No. Thank you, Danny. the master of understatement. And the music, it's the scene is set up like he could die. I firmly expected Norman to die by the end of this film, actually. I don't know if I'm the only one, because I was just thinking, like, he can talk to the dead. They're the only people who accept him.
I like that idea.
But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That thought didn't really cross my mind.
I crossed my mind.
Well, it didn't cross my mind because it became a monster movie.
Right.
So it came about him surviving and him, you know, keeping the town afloat. But, like, I think that's an idea that would have developed into, like, from a more kind of organic character study.
Yeah. But yeah, so like when, and the crazy thing is, he's trying to escape the zombies, which makes sense because no one wants to get bitten or eaten or anything. So he's trying to escape them. And then he finds out that they're awful even more so than he thought because they were responsible for the murder of this little girl. But then they come to him and entreat him for help anyway. And even though he has suffered at the hands of people like this, once again, not to the extent of the witch, he goes and tries to help them anyway. Like, that to me is ridiculously powerful storytelling, and just narratively is pretty nuanced and insane. Like, there turns out to be absolutely no bad guys in this movie because it doesn't believe in, like, strict moral certainty. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me what you... obviously, that's me posting a preemptive defense. So what did you two find egregious about this scene that you were saying it kind of felt shoehorned in and had to be done instead of wanting to be done?
Does Danny want to go?
Yeah, I can go.
I didn't mean to scare off any statements.
I just think that, like, you mentioned the fact that there are no bad guys, and that to me felt less like a conscious... less than a consciously nifty move on the screenwriter's part than it felt like just a way for them to, like, hammer home themes and lessons that, like, parents could go home telling their kids. Because honestly, like, the last like 10 or 15 minutes has so many lines where it's almost like Norman or, like, the head judge of the zombie group are just, like, talking directly to kids in the audience to, like, teach them lessons about outcasts and things like that. And that's kind of one of the main things that bugged me about it. And then there's a scene where he's actually talking to the witch girl. You know, he says something like just about accepting people. And, like, it just felt like that was something that could have came more naturally through the story and didn't need to be, like, said so explicitly so many times.
Yeah. I mean, I guess... speaking of leeway, do I give this movie a little more because it's a kid's film in that sense? Is that being unfair? Like, I can't really figure out.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, as far as this stating things openly, if it is a kid's film,
yeah.
Well, maybe.
I guess I'm thinking, well, I would say this. I think it handles that much better than something like Brave, which is so bald-faced. But also very, I think at its heart, very confused as well. So they outdid Pixar there. How about that?
They did. They did outdo Pixar. I can see what you're saying about, I don't know, the idea of stating something so openly. Do you have were you able to kind of, in your mind, create a story beat that would have been able to do that more nuanced?
Well, I mean, like, to me, like, my favorite parts of the movie are at the beginning. And there's basically just inherent conflict in that sequence where not only do people at school pick on him, but his parents almost don't like him. And maybe I'm imagining this, but I think they even talk about sending him, like, to a relative at one point. Do you remember that, or am I making that up?
I think what you're thinking of is when they were hoping that he hadn't been in contact with...
Okay, with Pendergast.
The crazy uncle.
Mm.
Who has one of the best... comedy scenes in the movie when he passes for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
Just like him dying and then his soul coming out but then zipping back in and him being like, all right, not yet, and then just falling again and then coming out and he's like, ah, yeah. Damn.
That was good.
I don't know why that stuck with me.
It's clever.
It is clever. Even though we're in spoilers, I don't want to give away all of the awesome, funny, incredible stuff that happens in this film, because I would hate to rob someone of the surprise and the joy that I felt watching this.
Yeah. You know what? I not to give too much away, but I found it particularly funny how the jock brother sort of isn't completely terrified at the zombie invasion. He's almost, like, really just sort of confused by it. He says something along the lines of, but the zombie thing really kind of threw me. And I don't know what it was about that line, but in the context of what had happened thus far in the movie, I just kind of, that line just kind of killed me.
Yeah, no, so. Most of what he says.
And now I'm laughing about it.
Most of what he says in this film is pretty spot on. I love that line that you just mentioned. Also him gloating about how much he was able to punt something.
Punted it 100 yards.
Yeah. Yeah, and the way that the Jock Brothers character pays off at the end, I think is... Pretty incredible. Not something that I saw coming. It was pretty awesome. Again, don't want to say specifically what it was, but it got one of the biggest laughs in my theater, actually. I think just because of the sort of out of left field nature of it. But yeah. Any final thoughts on this movie before we move on to taking a look at the week ahead? I mean, I would almost want to argue with you more about the story beats, but I don't feel like I'm going to change anyone's mind. And I feel like I've made my opinion pretty clear, and to speak more about it would be folly.
I mentioned this before, but the music is really impressive by John Bryan.
Oh yeah, the music, especially during the scene when Norman enters, I don't even know how to explain it, the like battle with the little girl.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounded exactly like The Fountain.
I was thinking that too.
Not only that, but visually it resembles The Fountain.
Which is another reason why I thought Norman was going to die. Not to give spoilers to The Fountain. I assume that everyone knows that there
is. Sorry. I love shouting that whenever somebody mentions The Fountain.
Just screaming Izzy?
Yeah.
Do you like The Fountain?
All right.
Noble failure.
It's okay.
It's okay. I love The Fountain. And I loved the music that was playing both in The Fountain and in this movie. And it did sound very much alike. And I think that it worked very well.
But it's so recognizable. I don't listen to the music from The Fountain other than when I watch the film. Mm-hmm. But even then, I was able to pinpoint it. Maybe it's because of, again, also it looks so similar too. But yeah.
And again, whoever was choosing songs and decided to listen and Fix Up Look Sharp, good work.
I also like how at Norman's school play, you hear the end of them singing Season of the Witch, which was in the trailer for the movie.
Yeah.
Thought that was nice.
And I just love the fidelity to real life in that it's awful.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like a bunch of little kids just kind of like half speaking, sort of in rhythm, the words to a song.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one final thing. This piece of wry comedy, a sea of little blinking red lights on video cameras, the battery dead on one of them, and the father saying how like we'll never be able to remember this now, or how will we ever remember this moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. This movie, I went in with vague expectations for at least a little bit of entertainment. I think I was just gobsmacked by how much I actually enjoyed this. And I definitely agree that it's probably, I don't even have to say probably, it's beaten out every other animated film that I've seen this year. It's the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Would everyone agree with me on that?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Studio Ghibli's Fest, whatever.
What else? What other animated movies have I seen besides Brave? I'm not even...
Madagascar, Europe's Most Wanted.
Oh, that movie? That movie I think I'll like more when I see it again in the future. Because it has a lot of like biblical references.
Like Noah's Ark, probably?
Yeah, it's really into that kind of storytelling, so I couldn't grasp it on a first viewing.
Well, I did think the subtext about Syria was particularly...
fascinating.
Yeah. That joke went as far as it could.
I was about to say, I can't even think of a way to begin to do that. But yeah, Paranorman, out in theaters now. Check it out, as we all said. I say definitely see it in 3D. But you know what? If you can't make it, if you can only see it in 2D, do that, because you're not going to want to miss this one. It's really good. And I'm already making plans to see it again with some people, and I'll probably buy it on DVD, too. I really like this movie, guys.
Happy for you. I like it, too.
I needed this. I needed this bad after the last couple of films we've seen. Good times. All right, speaking of films that we've seen, it's time to move on to our look to the week ahead and then our random recommendations before closing out this wonderful podcast. So, let's take a look at what's coming out into theaters and on DVD, and we can tell you what we think is probably your... best chance to see something worthwhile. Or not, because now that I'm looking at the DVDs coming out... Oh, no, wait, there are two or three good ones. It's just that the first one I saw was The Dictator.
Danny liked that movie.
Yeah, The Dictator, I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
Jesus.
I think I could comfortably recommend a Separation before The Dictator.
Yeah, I was going to say that might
but,
be.
But
I've heard great things about Bernie as well.
The characters in A Separation are facing the ire of the dictator.
that's well done. Yeah.
I think we all remember that I fucking hated the dictator.
Oh yeah.
So I'll say that you should never look in the direction of a copy of that film.
Banned and unrated.
Yeah. God damn it! I hate this movie so much. I almost want to see it just so I can talk about it again. Because I had some fun discussing how shitty that movie was with my friends. And I don't get enough of that in my life. Really, I'm fine with a bad movie. I'm just tired of movies that bore me, kind of like The Bourne Legacy did. That movie has not aged well in my mind, by the way. So
over a week.
Over a week.
The aging process.
I think that I didn't recommend it last week. I said, like, you shouldn't see it, and I've told people in my life not to see it, and I'm more and more in favor of that opinion now. Past Brian was absolutely correct. Also coming out, Chimpanzee from Disney. Did anyone see that?
No, it's not really my thing.
If you like chimpanzees, this is good for you. What was that?
I was just going to say that I did see Bernie, which you mentioned earlier, and I liked it. Mostly for Jack Black's performance. It feels like I saw it a couple months ago, and it feels a little bit forgettable by now in terms of like what Linklater is capable of, but I still enjoyed it. And it's actually like a really, really good performance by Jack Black.
I'm not really a Richard Linklater fan, to be honest, so I might never see that.
I've heard good things, good enough that I'll probably give it a rental and see what it's all about.
Oh, and Matthew McConaughey is a blast.
Yeah, that is kind of a selling point for me.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, because that's probably one thing that could get you to maybe see it.
Yeah, I've heard there was an AV Club piece about the Renaissance, since I know that Nick hates it when I say that
in a non-American way.
A Renaissance. I can't even remember how I said it that time. But yeah, about the rebirth of Matthew McConaughey as like a good, legitimate, not lazy actor. And Bernie was definitely in there. So is Killer Joe, which I'm still hoping to get out to see.
Fun movie.
God, I hate you. I need to see more films. This is crushing me. My soul is dying slowly. Nick, you're usually our voice for interesting re-releases and Criterion stuff. Anything you want to highlight?
Criterion's releasing Weekend from Andrew Hay. That's not the Jean-Luc Godard criticism of a bourgeois culture film. That's coming out in November from Criterion. That's a great film. You should check that out when you get the chance. This is the British drama about a gay couple. It's funny, last week my recommendation was a Hong Kong drama about a gay couple. So we're same-sex couples are hopping all over the world. And I'm going with them.
I was about to say, you're right next
I don't
to
know him. What that implies. Maybe but yes, Weekend. I've heard it's very good, and it's on Netflix Watch instantly. I just kind of always forget that it's there. And then I'm scrolling past, I go, oh, it's that, but I'm planning to watch something else. I suppose this is now more incentive to see it.
I think everyone suffers under that with a Netflix Watch instant.
Well, it's always like, you know, I'm going to watch that next, and then you're never in the mood for it.
Yeah. You're always just going to sit down and watch Future Sport.
I don't even know what that is.
It's a terrible movie. Do not watch Future Sport.
Also, you know what's coming out is Freelancers, starring Robert De Niro, Forest Whitaker, and 50 Cent.
Yeah, I saw that. Wow. Conscious decision not to talk about it, but since we're getting into that, yeah, apparently that's coming out.
Holy crap, Thinner is coming out on Blu-ray.
Thinner?
The Stephen King Thinner about the fat guy. Thinner?
Yeah, that's wait a second. I can't get Ravenous on Blu-ray, but Thinner is coming out onto Blu-ray.
Fucking Thinner is coming out on Blu-ray. Oh my god.
That's
the movie where Joe Mantegna covers up the death of a gypsy woman.
So. Yeah, and then he gets cursed and he starts losing weight, wasting away.
Well, Joe Mantegna is just like his friend.
Oh yeah,
he's not the lead actor.
He's not the guy who gets thinner. Jesus Christ, I'm so upset right now. I really want to see what? How do they release things on Blu-ray? Like, what do they just like?
Who supervised the transfer for Thinner? Was it director Tom Holland?
Author Stephen King.
I'm looking at pictures from this movie on Google Images right now. This is embarrassing.
Second assistant.
He's wearing a fat suit.
Jesus. Again, I can't get Ravenous on DVD, but Thinner apparently. Or I can't get Ravenous on Blu-ray, I should say. Ah, damn it. Have you all seen Ravenous?
No.
No.
Speaking of memorable music and movies, Ravenous. Check it out. Love it. That's completely unrelated to anything, though.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Yes, excellent. Coming out into theaters August 24th, we have Premium Rush, which features Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a bike messenger being pursued by something. I don't know. I can't.
Michael Shannon.
I was about to say Michael Shannon. Check out the trailer. It could be dumb fun. We also have The Apparition, which looks like a crappy horror film. Hit and Run, which stars Dax Shepard, Kristen Bell, and Bradley Cooper. Danny and I were speaking about this before we started recording. To me, this movie, when I first, I shouldn't say when I first saw the trailer, every time I see the trailer, I think it's not real. Like, it's, or it's like one of those TV shows that somehow gets a trailer before a movie.
Mm.
You know, I don't know. It's,
yeah, I'd agree with that.
It's
definitely
ridiculous.
But it could be great, so maybe check it out.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, who knows? I don't know. I probably won't see it. It just absolutely does nothing for me. Samsara, Sleep.
The movie that touted 70mm production process, would, and they didn't make 70mm prints for it.
Yeah. I don't... why?
I don't know.
Ridiculous.
Apparently it looks great in digital. Granted. But...
70mm, though. Come on. They're showing the master in 70mm. I don't know. The world makes no sense to me. It's supposed to be great. You should check it out if it's around you. Also getting a lot of good reviews and also enigmatic as far as where it's playing. Sleepwalk With Me by writer-director Mike Birbiglia, the well-known stand-up. And that's about it. Yes, so anyone have any of these that they particularly are looking forward to? I know that I personally can't wait to see Sleepwalk With Me when it finally hits DC in like 2 or 3 weeks. But is anyone like jonesing for some premium Rush or Apparition?
It's kind of slim pickings out there.
We'll have to figure out what we're reviewing, because I am not paying to see Premium Rush.
I mean, I like biking, like once a year.
I like biking. I ride my bike regularly. I just rode it today, in fact. Huh. I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I love Michael Shannon. David Coep has missteps, but he's done some great work. Movie's not going to happen.
What would you say is David Coep's great work from a directorial standpoint?
Ghost Town is fun. It's not great, but it's very underappreciated.
Did he do Stir of Echoes?
Yeah.
Okay, I can get behind him then. Still probably won't see Premium Rush. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, I have no idea what we're going to be reviewing next week. So that's even more of a reason to tune in, because it's a little mystery that's going to haunt you until you finally hear us talk about something.
Or they could just read the headline on the site.
Ouch.
I'm gonna make it an X. I'm just going to make it a mystery. I'm not even going to open next podcast by saying what the movie is. I'm going to draw this out. Speaking of drawing this out, we can probably bring this section to a close, and we can give our brief random recommendations of something that we've seen this week independently that we think you all at home should check out. Danny, why don't you start us off?
Well, I'm going to go with Michael Haneke's The Piano Teacher, very surprisingly is about a piano teacher, and it's quite the jolt of disturbing content from start to finish, really, just kind of relentless, disturbing depictions, but I did enjoy it. I almost think that it's one of the Haneke movies that I've liked on just a pure enjoyment level, because I'm not sure how deep it is beyond just accurately depicting a really messed up woman. But you know, it's obviously well directed, and it's fun, even though it's nutty, and it's on Netflix Instant, so...
I'm not particularly fond of that film, but maybe I shouldn't rain on that parade.
I enjoyed it. It's not,
so I'll just move on anyway.
It's not the best.
This week I'll recommend, what do I want to talk about? How about Coffee and Cigarettes, a Jim Jarmusch film from 2003. You guys seen it? Anybody?
I have not.
Is that the short film thing?
Yeah, it's a collection of short films.
Okay, I think I've seen like one or two of them.
Yeah, it's very good. And one of my biggest problems with anthology movies is that they often feel disconnected, and it feels like I'm watching three or four different things at once. This is something like 12 stories. If you just kind of watch them, they seem disconnected, but if you really think about them, you see that there's very interesting overlaps going on in them. It's really really entertaining too. It's so well written, and it's got beautiful black and white cinematography. I don't like Coffee, I don't like Cigarettes, but I loved Coffee and Cigarettes.
Holy shit.
That's a great recommendation.
Yeah. And that is an incredible statement.
Can you even move on?
No, I can't. You've ruined me. I'm just picturing like one of these critics who's gotten like really lethargic and easygoing, like has a public access television show and has to finish every review with a line like that. Just like in his sweater, looking Sandy earnestly Kenny. Into the camera, saying, "I don't like coffee. I don't like cigarettes. but I like coffee and cigarettes.
I think only Danny would know. I don't think Brian would. You know what I'm talking about, right, Sandy Kenyon, if you ever go in the back of a cab?
No, actually. I don't drive any cabs, yeah.
He does ABC 7, so when you're back in New York.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, I didn't have a TV last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I take the subway most of the time, so.
All right, so you were cut off, but he does the Eyewitness News Movie Minute.
I gotta get on that.
That's how he says it. It's good.
All right, a little inside baseball there. I guess
sort of like the new Gene Shalit.
Oh, Gene Shalit.
Wow.
Damn. Moving on. I guess my recommendation, I don't know, I got two, so I'll go through them both real quick. The first is a documentary called Resurrect Dead. It's on Netflix Instant. It's not too long. You should check it out. It's about these Toynbee idea tiles, which are these odd mosaic tiles that are in a bunch of different cities across the world. And these three misfits who try to figure out where these tiles are coming from. It's an interesting story. It's an interesting movie. And just everything behind it's kind of... I'm going to say interesting again. God damn it. It's too late on a Sunday for this. But yeah, it's a good movie, and you should check it out. The next one that I'm going to recommend to you all is actually called Goon. Sean William Scott. It's a hockey movie, but not quite really a hockey movie because it's more about the fighting during hockey. But even then, I mean, if you're not into sports movies, this is still a great one because who knew he could act really well? And yeah, just the direction's interesting and fun. I don't know. It's a lightweight film, but I enjoyed it a lot and I got behind the character.
I also liked that movie.
Yeah, and I mean, I tried getting some people to watch it, and they're like, I don't like sports movies. Can you agree that this is not a sports movie, per se?
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar experience. I couldn't find anyone to see it with me, but the Sean William Scott character is just kind of like a lovable goof, and so you just kind of, like, enjoy watching him. And sports-wise, yeah, it's more about the fighting and kind of the philosophy of how they go about their job. Lee Schreiber is really good.
Yeah.
In a short role.
Yeah, short role, but he's really great in it. So yeah, check those both out. They're both on Netflix Instant. I've made your jobs easier for you this week. Next week I'll try to give you something that you can't find. But yeah, that's where we're at today. Brings us to the end of this podcast. Hopefully you've enjoyed listening to us as much as we have enjoyed talking at you. Let's give everyone an idea of where we can be found on our off time, and then we can sign off. So Nick, why don't you tell us where we can find you on the net?
Filmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman. I just got an iPhone today, so I might be tweeting from that now. I was going to say tweeting more, but I tweeted from my regular phone. I would just send a text message.
Oh man!
So am I really going to tweet more from it? Probably not. You'll probably get more twit pics of stupid stuff, but not Instagram.
Not Instagram?
Don't worry. You don't have to worry about those stupid filtered sepia things going on.
I
sound like David Letterman or somebody right now. Yeah, no Instagram.
All right. And no bueno.
Yeah, I'll look forward to your twit pics. You can find my writing on the film stage, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And you can find me online at dearfilm.net, my personal blog. You can also find me at filmstage.com and twitter.com/BrianJRellin. So thanks for joining us. And again, tune in next week to find out what movie we are going to review. It is a mystery. Anyone really excited about any of these? I can personally say that I can't wait to see Sleep With Me like 3 weeks from now when it finally comes to DC.
Sleepwalk With Me.
Sleepwalk With Me.
Sleep With Me is a
Jesus.
You know what? I don't even know how to come back from that. I can't wait to see Sleepwalk With Me. Jesus Christ. I'm going to have to edit that out or something. That's going at the end.
Post credits.
Post credits.